Welcome back. Today, I share with you the conversation I had with Britt Barker. Britt is a musician and a producer, and some of you might have known him as the son of former Clemson University president Jim Barker. But I can tell you, moving forward, I think a lot of people will get to know him from his music and what he is creating. Britt has had a lot of adversity in his life, and a common theme to me during this conversation is his strength and willingness to get through it all. And he has found himself in some unbelievable circumstances where anywhere from having to go to jail for 90 days, breaking his hand and getting addicted to opioids and eventually heroin. But you know what? Coming out of all of that and through his music and world travel, becoming the person he is today, where he has found peace and he has found a sense of balance in his life, and he is really creating some really awesome music. So I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. I know I did. Britt's awesome. He is now living in Greenville. If you enjoy the conversation, please share it with some friends and family. Give us a nice 5-star rating on Apple Podcast. And of course, if you're looking for a new mattress, you got to reach out to the team at Engineered Sleep. Engineered Sleep is a mattress manufacturer. They are based out of Greenville, South Carolina. And I can tell you from personal experience, and anybody that sleeps in my guest bedroom, Engineered Sleep, their mattresses are the best. And what their main goal is to work with you and make sure finding the right mattress for you is as easy as possible. And that's exactly what they do. So reach out to Engineered Sleep. Use promo code LIVE10, either in person or on their website at engineeredsleep.com. You'll get 10% off your order. And most importantly, you'll start sleeping better and in turn start performing better. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Britt Barker. Welcome to Live Life in Motion, where the goal is to bring you conversations that give you the power of education so you can use those tools to optimize your life on a personal and professional level to better yourself, your community, and those around you. Britt, thank you for coming in today. I think we're going to find a lot of similarities between our stories, but I've been reading a lot about you and listening to some interviews, and my good buddy Blair Rushing sent me your story, and I couldn't wait to have you on. So thank you for coming, and I'm excited for the conversation.
Yeah, I'm super stoked to be here. Glad that there's somebody out here doing this kind of thing. So I think it's good for Greenville and for the world, man. So I appreciate it.
No problem. I do, like you said, you know, the stories behind some of the stories that people don't always hear mm-hmm. are the most meaningful stories that people might need to hear when they're in one of those dark places, or they're needing an outlet to learn that they're not alone in some form or fashion. And these stories bring light to that, which, you know, is very impactful. And I'm just pumped to go through your story. And let's start back. So you grew up in Clemson?
Mm-hmm. Moved there when I was 2 years old. Born in Mississippi, Starkville, where Mississippi State is. Mm-hmm. And then moved to Clemson when I was 2.
And I mean, talk about your childhood. And you had a brother?
Mm-hmm. Had an older brother. He's 10 years older. So, you know, he was really good at being an older brother. Like, he was like that quintessential older brother, like made time to hang out, even though like I was younger. So it was probably not as convenient for him to like, or cool to be with like a 10-year younger brother. But he always made time. So that was really cool. Was really active. Parents are still together. They were together. Good relationship. I mean, not perfect. But you know, I had a pretty awesome childhood. I mean, I had everything I needed. Was always outside. You know, got a lot of love from my parents and from my brother. You know, it was like a high standard in the house, which, you know, my dad was pretty successful. My brother played baseball at North Carolina. So he was like a really good athlete, good student. My mom, you know, ran a kindergarten and, you know, taught like preschool and stuff like that. So everybody like kind of had their ducks in a row.
On the outside.
Yeah, on the outside for sure. And so, you know, it was really good. I went to school. Like, I didn't, school wasn't the top of my priority list, like really ever until later in life.
I can relate.
Yeah. But I mean, you're kind of forced to go and get through it, kind of like just gnashing your teeth the whole way, or at least I was. But you know, like I did learn how to interact with people, and I had great friends. I think, you know, one of your friends that you was interviewing you on your edition of the podcast, he said that, you know, you had such a big support system, a lot of friends, a lot of family. And I that resonated with me. I've had kind of the same group of friends all the way through. And then through those people, you get support from their parents, you know, their brothers and sisters and whatever. So it's like this web of connection. And so that was really good growing up.
Of course. And yeah. I mean, that also kind of is a sign of who you are as a person. When you have those relationships and that support groups, because I mean, a lot of people don't have that, which is, I mean, I didn't really realize it until I went to treatment, but I felt so lucky that I had these people that had my back. Mm-hmm. And then you look at people that don't, and I don't know if I would have ever made it through if I didn't have that support system. With high school, you're also a pretty good soccer player, right?
Mm-hmm.
Played at Daniel, played against my alma mater, Greenville High, a few
all
times.
All the time, man. Some great rivalries there.
Did you feel, I know you mentioned your pops, and he worked at the university. Did you feel pressure to go to Clemson?
No, not from him or from anyone else, but I felt like pressure from myself because it was just so familiar. I saw how fun it looked. You know, like I was a senior and junior in high school living on campus in the president's house. And, you know, I'm sitting there like seeing all this fun that all these young kids are having, and it looked really attractive to me. So like, you know, there might've been some opportunities to walk on at some smaller schools, for soccer, maybe try to get on a scholarship, but I took some tours and it just seemed like such a small, version of Clemson. Mm-hmm. And Clemson was just this big, like, uncharted, like, you know, territory, frontier. And so I was pretty excited about that.
Was that when, I know you mentioned in a recent interview I listened to where you, I mean, kind of dabbled in alcohol like most high schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you got to Clemson, is that when you started experimenting with more drugs and alcohol? When did that kind of start?
Yeah, I had a pretty, you know, typical kind of first, you know, act of my substance use. The first act was, you know, snuck in my parents' liquor cabinet, got drunk, you know, a couple times. But the thing that stands out back then about that is like, I remember that first drunk very, very well. And my brain remembered it. Despite the fact that like after 45 minutes of pure bliss, I was super sick. I didn't remember any of that. I just remembered that like magical 45 minutes where everything was just like, oh, you know, that feeling. And I'm sure some of our listeners will know what that feels like, you know?
It's almost like, it's hard to describe, but I remember feeling like a calmness. Like I felt at ease. I felt like I could be myself.
100%.
And then, all right, so you're at Clemson and you're there for a year. And what year is this?
I graduated high school in 2013, and you know, I did a summer program to get in to like, it was like a bridge program. And then I started in the fall of 2003. Yeah. And I was living on campus, so I did fine. I got by, I think like a 3.0, which was good compared to what was coming. But as soon as I moved off campus, I started playing music. I'd always been playing music. I've been playing music since I was in fourth grade, and even a little bit before that, just like playing around on my parents had all these weird instruments from all over the place, like just obscure kind of mandolins and sitars and stuff, which is really cool. So I just remember banging on those when I was little. But yeah, I moved off campus, and that's when it was like, all right, you got to pick a path. Looking back, I should have picked a path, like either music and no school and like work or whatever, or school. But I tried to do both. And that was where like my kind of people pleasing came in. Like you mentioned that on your episode of your podcast. you know, I was just trying to appease everybody, you know, keep my parents happy by being in school instead of actually being like, hey, I don't really want to be here. I don't know what I want to study. This is way too much for me right now, but just trying to do both. So that's like kind of the thing that a lesson that I learned, you know, is like kind of like just honor, you know, what your intuition is and what you want to do, mm-hmm. you know?
And a lot of people don't though. I mean, they follow that path of trying to please everybody.
Right.
When did you leave Clemson for the first time?
Probably like 06 or 07. Yeah.
And did you took a trip to Nicaragua? Is that around that time?
Yeah, I did. I was feeling pretty lost, just, you know, struggling in school. What would happen is I would fake it all semester, like maybe go to class a few times and then like just kind of fake it. And then once grades came around, it was like this big like throwdown. Like I have to like scramble to like cover my ass and, mm-hmm. you know, get all that stuff in order. And it was so stressful. So like, I think after the second one of those semesters, it was like, all right, got to do some changes. So my aunt and uncle have been connected down in Nicaragua for a while. They, you know, bought a house down there like back in the 70s and have started doing mission work. So they knew some people. They weren't living there at the time, but they knew this school and this camp where I could go down and teach and work and, you know, pretty much just have like my room and board paid for. Mm-hmm. And then that was during the week. And then during the weekends, I could go stay at my aunt and uncle's house and get like a real shower and sleep with air conditioning and, you know, like kind of let loose in the city of Granada. And
nice.
It's really old. It's like right on Lake Nicaragua. And I could just go there and kind of unwind and like have fun. And then during the week, kind of have that structure of teaching. I was teaching English and music to preschoolers. I was there for 6 months and
that's pretty awesome, man.
It was transformative. I was like 22, maybe 23. And
part of the world too is incredible. I was just down in Costa Rica not too long ago, mm-hmm. and just is so beautiful. And the people are so nice and friendly.
Yeah.
I've never been to Nicaragua, but I feel like it's probably pretty similar.
Yeah, it's real similar. I would say I've been to Costa Rica a couple of times, and I would say Nicaragua was like kind of where Costa Rica was probably like 15 years ago.
Okay.
All the same type thing. The people are just wonderful. But yeah, that was one of those things where I went by myself. And once I got back, like it was an adventure. I mean, mm-hmm. there's some wild times down there, like just sketchy situations, like all this stuff. And when I got back, it was one of those things like where I had a lot of confidence in myself. I might not have been aware of it, but I never really doubted myself going forward about whether I could or couldn't do something because of that trip.
What was your substance use at the time before you went to Nicaragua?
Drinking a lot. Like, I mean, you know, just getting obliterated all the time.
Like daily?
Man, like four or five days a week for mm-hmm. sure. You know, some weed. And then I started dabbling in a lot of cocaine back then, selling a little bit, you know, doing a lot. And that was a wild time. But that was about that, around that time, just drinking and coke and some weed at that point.
Did you know somewhere in your mind that this was an issue, or like, you know, different than how other people might have been using it?
I think somewhere, because like I knew if I, at that point I was kind of like basing what I should or shouldn't do kind of like on how I was raised, mm-hmm. You know, which is normal. Like, what else would I base that on? You know?
Yeah, sure.
So like I knew it was like going against that kind of code.
Mm-hmm.
But I was hanging out with so many people that were doing the same type thing. I mean, I was probably one doing it the most. Mm-hmm. Like I was always taking it to the extreme. But I would be with people, you know, that are kind of doing the same thing. So it gives you a way more easier way to justify it,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is kind of subconsciously by design with most people that are doing stuff like that.
Yeah, I can agree with you there. When you got back, did you get back into music? What was your first, what'd you do when you got back from Nicaragua?
Well, I think I tried to get back into school maybe, but I was like, nah, this isn't happening. But around that time I met a guy named Jordan Miller. He was one of the founding members of a band called The Movement out of Columbia, South Carolina. And me and my buddy Drew Carranzas, who played drums, we had been playing drums since we were like in the fifth grade, drums and bass. I played bass, he played drums. We were wakeboarding a lot, listening to this Movement's first EP. It's just like these two guys and this like DJ drum machine type thing. It was really cool, like reggae, kind of hip hop rock. And all of a sudden, Jordan appears in Clemson. And he's playing acoustic shows downtown because his girlfriend, he's like living with his girlfriend while she's about to graduate. So he's there for a while. And finally, me and Drew go introduce ourselves and say, hey, man, big fans. Like, would you ever want to play with like a live drummer and a live bass player? And he's like, absolutely. So we went and played this fraternity party that night without practicing anything. We just plugged in and started jamming. And it went off. It was great. And it was first time he had played with a live band. So he was super stoked. Me and Drew finally had an awesome frontman, because this guy's one of the most talented, you know, frontmen I've been around. And so we started a little side project called The Executives. And, you know, at that point we opened up for the Wailers and like kind of touring around, doing little runs around the East Coast. And it was really fun. It was really fun. Went up to Philly and played some music up there. And that was kind of like where the music was kind of keeping everything on track. I mean, I was still obviously drinking a lot, but because we had this music and there was like some pretty quick little bit of success, it was like, oh, it's not causing any problems, you know, because everything else is in order, right?
Is the Wailers, is that the band connected to the Marleys?
Yeah. Yeah. His Bob Marley and the Wailers.
Dang.
Yeah, it was cool. I was a bass player and getting to share a stage with Aston Family Man Barrett, you know, which is like the guy that's been playing with Bob his whole life, hanging out on the tour bus afterwards, you know, there's, yeah, it was really cool.
So what was life like that at home? Were you living back at your parents' house? Did you have, you know, a house to yourself? What was?
Yeah, I think I was just renting a place in Clemson at that point. I always could go stay at my parents' house, which I would, like if I was ever, you know, if we would play like, you know, four shows in a row, I'd come back up and kind of go there and like, you know, detox kind of, you know. Like be hungover for like 4 days and get up and do it again. But yeah, I think I had my own place. So I was just kind of bouncing around though a lot. We'd stay on the road a good bit too.
How did, you know, your life kind of escalate in substance use from, I mean, honestly, it's so common. People are in a band, they're doing alcohol, they're doing some cocaine, but somehow they keep it together. When was, you know, you escalated to other drugs? When did that start happening?
So in 2009, I moved to Charleston permanently because we were playing more and more down there. So it just made more sense. But I broke my hand. And like I had taken painkillers before and it never really like grabbed a hold of me. But I remember breaking my hand and getting put on, you know, some Percocet. And it was just right place, right time. Like I was like, cause alcohol was just, it's just not sustainable. Like to keep drinking like that, you know, like it's just, I was partying too much, gaining weight, like, you know, just not feeling good at all. And then once I got these Percocets, I ate that and I was like, oh my gosh, it was one of those moments. Like the first time I ever drank, it was like, this is the thing I've been looking for my whole life. Cause alcohol, I would just get in trouble, you know, fights with the girlfriend, like all the drama that goes along with it. But this, when I finally had those opiates, it was like, I'm in control. Like I feel great. You know, I can talk to anybody. It's totally different ball game. So that was like,
Do you think you were running away from something? What do you think you know, when you had those opioids, those pills, what was that relief from? Do you know?
I think a lot, and man, this is, you know, I'm still learning about that. Today as you know, I get to know myself more. But I think, I mean, it's so complex, but I think there's some elements of it. Like I was just so like not settled or not content with where I was in my life. Like I had started a bunch of great things, but never really saw anything through, like school, you know, music was kind of like, it was going on the back burner. Jordan started playing with the Movement again. They're wildly, like wildly successful band, especially now. But, you know, I was just like, I was so unfulfilled. And I think I was just aware of that. Like I saw my friends like doing well and everyone, you know, to me at that point seems like they got their shit together. You know, everybody, I'm like, what's wrong with me? You know, I can't really hold a job, not making money like I want to. The music's kind of going slow. So I think it was just, it just made me feel more comfortable about like who I was and where I was in my life at that point.
And how long did you spend in Charleston?
I was there from 2009 to 2010 and like in the middle of 2010. And then I finally got an idea of like what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to Full Sail in Orlando, which is a recording art school. And this is what I was going to do. Like I did, I busted my ass to like get everything, get grants to go and to get it all funded and paid for as much as possible. And like all the stuff, like I moved back to Clemson for a football season, worked at a bar at Loose Change and just, you know, tried to save as much money as I could before I went down there. But that whole time, like I was picking up my like opiate use, you know, just pills and stuff and drinking and then too.
Were you still calling that same doctor? How were you getting the pills at this point?
At this point, it was on the street. Yeah.
Is that where you met my good, or not in the use, but Blair Rushing at Loose Change?
Yeah.
I remember multiple nights going up to Clemson and Blair was slinging shots at Loose Change.
That's a great place, man. Like that, I mean, for all its debauchery, like it's a really special, like special place for sure.
It is. I had Graham Howe on the podcast, who's one of the owners.
Oh yeah, he's great.
Of Loose Change. And all right, so you kind of have your stuff together, even though you are ramping up your opioid use. You get down to Florida. And then what happens then?
Katie bar the door. Like, I mean, it's no secret that drugs are pretty prevalent in Orlando and in Florida. So it was only a matter of time. Like while like I was so excited about the potential of this new journey going to recording art school and what that may lead to, like equally is like gaining momentum was my use.
Can you describe that feeling of like when you get pills? Like, because it's almost this like, for me, I remember like having so much anxiety that I didn't have any Xanax, and then even before I even took them, and I've, you know, if I got my prescription refilled, there was, I felt better. You know, it's like the craziest feeling.
It's that psychosomatic kind of thing. It's real.
Your brain is literally playing tricks on you, and you don't even know it at the time because you think now like, oh man, I'm good now.
I know, it's wild.
But so did you finish school down there?
No, I lasted about probably 2 or 3 weeks, and I had found a connection, and I was like eating, I mean seriously got to a point where I was eating like 15 lore tabs a day. You know,
what'd your life look like then? Were you just sitting at home trying to find pills?
Yeah, I was, you know, it was kind of real similar to when I was in Clemson. Like I knew I had these responsibilities, like going to class. So I would do just a little bit to kind of get by, but there's a certain line that I cross. It's just fuck itville. Like I crossed the line into that place and I could really easily just shove all that stuff aside and just, if I ignore it, it'll go away. Which is, you know, that was where I think, you know, pathologically, like that's how I could continue on that path. Like, I mean, people will listen to that and people that I was around would be like, man, like, why can't you, you know, why don't you can't just do like you what you're supposed to do? It's hard to explain to somebody because like the mechanism that is hijacked, that's like determining what decisions you make, you know, like it's completely like screwed up.
That's a good way to describe it, is hijacked. It's not you making those decisions anymore.
Right.
It's the disease, it's the addiction, it's all that combined in your brain, which is so hard for people to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Because I even would think before, you know, I learned and got more educated about it, it's like, man, why don't people just stop? Why don't they just decide to do the right thing? And it's totally not up to them.
Mm-hmm.
What was your family like at this point? What were your friends? Were anybody trying to interject, trying to, you know, did they notice you had issue, you know, notice you had substance abuse issues?
Yeah. My girlfriend at the time, like we were like really in love, but she, you know, she couldn't be with someone like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just the ups and downs and the chaos and the drama. So she kind of separated herself. But really, like halfway through that first semester is when I realized, I mean, I was doing fentanyl patches, like all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I finally like broke down after on like a Sunday in Charleston in Shim Creek outside of Red's. I remember that gravel parking lot. And it
Dang,
was,
I've been there.
Yeah, it's a fun place. But I had that moment where I was like, man, something's not right, you know? And I don't know what, like, I guess it's just one of those lows after being like partying so high. Mm-hmm. You get that introspective kind of lull afterwards. Yep. And I broke down and called my parents and I said, hey, I need help. Like something's off. Like this isn't just a normal thing. Like there's something else going on here.
Did you go right into treatment then?
Yeah. After a couple of weeks, you know, this was all brand new to us. And while it wasn't surprising, I don't think to my parents, it's still like, okay, cat's out of the bag, but now what?
Mm-hmm.
So we did a lot of research and, you know, we found a place called Pavilion up in Mill Spring.
Yep.
And I went and that was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. I mean, seriously, like I've done a lot of crazy things and intense things. That was the most terrifying thing, going to treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I was like, man, all my secrets are going to be out. Like everyone's going to know what kind of monster I am, you know, like that's what I'm thinking in my head.
Yeah. What are people going to think about you? Are they going to treat you the same way? Are they going to, you know, push you aside? Like all those sort of feelings, which is so scary for someone like you, right? You're trying to please most of the people around you.
Mm-hmm. They're a really social person. Yeah.
And then your secrets are coming out, which, yeah. I mean, then you look back at it and it wasn't nearly probably as bad as you thought.
Not at all. It was the best thing ever. Yeah.
Live Life in Motion podcast is brought to you by Engineered Sleep. Engineered Sleep is a mattress manufacturer, and they are based out of Greenville, South Carolina. They have been making mattresses for as long as I can remember, and their main goal is to make finding the quality mattress for you as easy as possible. They have a showroom in Greenville, but you can also visit them at their website, engineeredsleep.com. If you go to their website, use code LIVE10 and you will get 10% off. As you guys know, sleep is the number one thing you need to focus on for good health. And it all starts with your mattress. So stop putting it on the back burner. Go get yourself a mattress from Engineered Sleep and start living a better life. That wasn't the end of the road for you there.
Oh, heck no.
So
that was just the beginning.
Just the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so talk us through the next, you know, I think this was 2011, the next 4 years. You're in and out of treatment. You eventually move on to other drugs. Kind of just walk us through that.
Yeah. So I got out of treatment and they wanted me to do aftercare. And I was like, no, I'm cured. I'm good. You got me in here with all these people smoking crack and robbing banks. I'm like, I'm fine. You know? So I went back down to Orlando. And that lasted probably like 3 days. I was unpacking. I moved into a new place and I was unpacking my stuff and found a little bag of Xanax.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, this will make putting this IKEA furniture way better, you know? So I pop one, get a 6-pack of Coors Light. And then next thing I know, I'm at the strip club, like bottles of liquor. And then the next thing I know, I wake up in a hospital bed, handcuffed to the bed. Two of my friends that lived in Orlando, standing at the end of the bed, looking at me like, what the heck?
Mm-hmm.
So apparently I was blacked out, obviously. And some police tried to pull me over when I was trying to drive home, and I didn't think that I was going to stop. You know, I just kept going, and they, like, a little bit of a chase ensued in downtown Orlando, and a street sweeper pulled out in front of me, and I crashed into him and went through the windshield.
Dang.
Yeah, no one else was hurt, which is like the most miraculous thing. But, you know, some pretty serious charges from that. And, you know, I think it was like a felony fleeing from police. And I was put on probation, and then I left the state and was supposed to do all these probation things. And, you know, just the master of pushing responsibilities aside, you know, pretending like if I just ignore it, it'll go away.
Mm-hmm.
So I was living in Greenville, Nashville, like trying to do recovery, like going to halfway houses, getting kicked out. Like here in Greenville, I went to Pavilion Halfway House, lasted about 3 weeks just because I couldn't stop using and drinking.
What were you using at this point?
Just pills. Like, I think, you know, at this point I had gone, took like Klonopin and Xanax and then alcohol, which for me is the worst combination, as far as just like inability to function and mm-hmm. getting in trouble. So then I went to Nashville. I had two good friends offer to let me stay with them if I was doing this outpatient program, just to let me get on my feet, which was awesome of them. But we all like kind of underestimated, the issue,
mm-hmm. the stronghold that it had.
Yeah. I mean, like I needed like serious inpatient help. So like outpatient just wasn't going to do it. I started using meth up there and then like went on some wild meth benders. And
do you remember the first time you used meth?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the first time I used meth was in Orlando. Actually, I was with this dude. We were like alligator hunting and he pulls it out. And it was a wild night, you know, like doing that and trying to hunt alligators. But yeah, I mean, it was, that was an intense one.
What about in Nashville?
Yeah, Nashville was up there and just got mixed in with this, like, the wrong crowd, so to speak. People that were selling it, getting it from drug cartels in Atlanta. Did a couple runs with them down there, and it was just a really hairy situation.
Mm-hmm.
I was on probation. You know, it was real stupid. Things could have gone, like, way haywire. But I got out of that situation and flew back down to Clemson. It was kind of like a escape in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you got back to Clemson, did you end up going back to Florida? What were your charges? You know, what was happening with your charges in Florida?
I was supposed to be doing community service and all that stuff, but that just was really inconvenient to me at the time. So the band started playing again, the executives, and we were booking more and more shows. So that became my focus. We were in Charleston recording an album, and we, you know, it was going good. I mean, I was pretty sloppy at the time. But we were leaving the studio one night. I was sober, but I got pulled over and they took my license and they came back and they said, "What's going on in Florida?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know. What are you talking about?"
Dang.
So they took me to jail.
Were you using heroin at this point?
I had used it a couple times, but not bad. It was just more of those things that was, if there wasn't any, you know, oxys around or something.
Yeah, yeah, true.
But I was in Charleston and they slapped me with a $2 million bond.
Yeah.
I had like a nationwide fugitive warrant out. And I hired a really good attorney, like my parents did. And he got that reduced. I got out and I had to go turn myself in Florida.
So they took you to jail in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of your release was, hey, I'm going to go back to Florida and turn myself
face
in.
The music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever that music, that tune might be. Yeah. So I was getting loaded like the 2 weeks before I left, all the way up until right before I walked into the jail cell, like anything that I could put in my body, I was putting it in it.
And were you at that point, were you thinking, hey, like, you know, were you still trying to push these feelings aside, these responsibilities, or was it almost like a death sentence? Almost like,
yeah,
some way of thinking I might even die from all these pills I'm putting in my body.
Yeah, at that point, I think my main objective was just to obliterate reality as much as possible and just let the cards fall where they may. I really didn't care. You know, the stress of all this legal stuff like was so bad. But I remember, yeah, just walking into that jail in Florida, not knowing how long I would be there, anything like that. That was rough. But I mean, I was so under the influence. But I ended up having seizures when I got like a couple of weeks after being in there, just like from the detox. And obviously, like they weren't doing anything to help the withdrawals.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that stint down there was not very fun.
How long were you in jail?
Probably like 90 days. And my attorneys came down and I couldn't call anyone because I was out of state. And so I was literally just sitting in there and like had no clue what was happening, like not knowing a timeline or anything. And I mean, I met some actually like decent people in there. I mean, obviously they weren't all like good people, but you know, we got by, we laughed, and it was what it was. It's interesting because I mean, I think about that, like if I can sit through those days, mm-hmm. you know, all this other stuff that like life kind of throws at you now, it's like, it's so much easier to cope and manage.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like 90 days they came down, got me out, and I had a lot of conditions upon my release. Like,
were you in jail? Were you in a solo?
No, it was this big dorm, like with bunks, like rows and rows of bunks. It was crazy. It was like,
what were the other people in there? Were they violent offenders? Were they drug offenders?
Everything. Yeah, it was gnarly. It was, I got lucky because people around me were really cool. I had a seizure falling off the top bunk, and there's this huge Cuban Latin King below me, like big dude. He likes, I guess he heard the commotion.
Mm-hmm.
He came out from under the bunk and like, as I was falling off, going to bust my neck and my teeth all up probably. He like caught me and pretty much like saved my ass. Mm-hmm. So like there's, you know, I had my little group around me there and they were cool. But yeah, I saw some pretty heinous things in there. It was, I couldn't believe that that's how it was set up. Like everybody in the open like that. Like it was wild.
When did you get word that, hey, I might be getting out?
So actually after that, like right after, well, no, I'd been in there for a little bit longer and my attorneys flew down and they came and visited me and they said, hey, we're here for trial. You know, hopefully we're going to be able to get you out. And that was quite the relief.
So you end up getting out 90 days in. Mm-hmm. What was your first move? Did you have any reflection period while you were in jail?
No.
No,
not at all. I came out of jail with more connections, like drug connections in mm-hmm. Orlando. Yeah, it was not a period of self-reflection, which I mean, it should have been, but I was so miserable. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, all I could think about was getting high.
What'd you do when you get out? When you got out?
I went to COP, was the first thing. And then
you went to a COP?
I went to COP. Oh, like go pick up some dope.
Got it. Yeah. Okay.
At that point, like I was ready to just go full heroin mode. Xanax would just do nothing but get me in trouble at that point. And obviously that was the third seizure I've had. So I was like, I'm not doing that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Coming off Xanax is
awful.
Awful.
Yeah. But yeah, so I came back up to, what was that? Probably about 2014. I came back up to Clemson and I had to go to treatment as part of one of the conditions that the judge ordered. So I went to this place called the Owl's Nest in Florence, South Carolina. It's compared to like place like Pavilion. It's like the last house on the left. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I learned a lot about recovery there. There's a lot of good people at that place. So shout out to the Owl's Nest.
Did you last in recovery there?
About 3 months. So it's a 4 month program. And they let you get a job and stuff. And it's so crazy. Like I was there like a few weeks and I went to the mall there. I was looking for shoes to get some new pair of shoes. And I end up walking into the Journeys. I end up walking out the assistant manager position. Like I got a job, you know, like good, just like crazy, right? Like I've heard the statement, like the worst thing for someone in recovery early is like, is good luck or something.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I believe that, but in that this case, it definitely enabled me to start using again. I found somebody that had Subutex in the mall, and Subutex wasn't going to show up on the drug screens at the place I was at. So that was like perfect.
What is Subutex?
It's like an opiate. It's like Suboxone, but you can actually get more of a buzz off it if you don't have an opiate tolerance. But at that point, I didn't have any opiate tolerance. So, you know, you do a little bit of that and you can feel pretty good and it won't show up on those drug tests. So that was like perfect for me.
Yeah. Were you drinking?
No drinking, just because it's harder to conceal.
Yeah.
But I would say I'd work late, and then like do an inventory or something, but then I'd be out like, and then I started doing some meth, and I did that for like, I mean, probably like a month, and I got back at like 2 a.m. one night, and one of the like leaders there like was up and saw me come back late, and they're like, we need to give him a drug test. And then the next day they said, hey, would you mind taking a drug test? I said, you can keep the drug test. I'm going to fail for everything, so I'll just pack my stuff. And then I left, but I still had my job. So I stayed in Florence, but my heroin use like took off. Like I found like a reliable connection there, and it got to a point where I was doing like $300 a day.
What was... Do you ever remember that time where you say you were clean and sober and then you used for the first time? Was it like a weak moment? Was it stress from something else? Do you remember what led you to that a couple times?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something that is thought out for me. Mm-hmm. Because there has to be a plan, especially when you're in a place like that, like you have to put together a plan. So I've been thinking about it for a while. And as soon as I start thinking like that, I'm going to do it.
You're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's happening. Mm-hmm. So you're in Florence and 2014. I know you've been in treatment a few times. When was the, I don't even know if I should call this, but when was the breaking point? When was like, this is the, I'm going to treatment. I'm, you know, giving up all these past thoughts and ideas of who I am. And I'm really just, I'm going in. Like, I need this.
Yeah. That, so like throughout, like fast forward about a year, like I had lived in Florence. I was still working at Journeys, but then like, you know,
what is Journeys?
It's a shoe store in the mall.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. It was awesome. It was a great job, but I left there. And you know, I went back to the Owl's Nest because I had to get this certificate of completion for the judge. I guess the whole reason why I was there. Mm. So I finally did that. Like I did their 30-day program just to get the certificate. And then I started working there. But then I was getting high, so I got kicked out. I got asked to leave. And then I went down to Myrtle Beach and I met up with Jordan, the friend of mine, the singer. And he was living there and we were working like on some music, or we were going to put together an album. But like I was... Man, running around Myrtle Beach like a madman, like doing speedballs and all sorts of stuff. And finally, like me and him got in the car and we were driving to Florence and I was going to go get some more dope. And I guess I fell asleep, ran off the road, got in a bad accident. And he got tuned up bad. I did too. He was worse though. But so I totaled my car, was in the hospital. You know, got out, moved back to Clemson. Like I was living at my parents' house. I think I was like 30 years old, living in the basement, still had this gnarly habit. And
were you hiding it from them?
Yeah. I mean, they knew, I think, but they're in denial too, you know, and I was so good at manipulating them. But I think that summer, it was like the summer and it just what was going on just wasn't sustainable. Like I would do a lot of heroin and I wouldn't even get relief from the withdrawal. Like I was still sick after doing like a lot. And I was like, fuck this. Like I did not sign up for this. Like I'm doing all this work to like, you know, get these drugs and then not even getting any of the relief from it. And I later learned that my liver was failing and that's why. But something just told me to call Pavilion again. I was like, I knew that it was serious at this point. Like I was, My mom even said later, she's like, I felt like I was watching you die slowly.
Yeah.
And that's, that was, there was just that little moment where it was like, all right, I have no car. I was riding my bike around town, just like the guy when I was younger. I'd see the wild drug addict guy ride his bike around town. That was me. I became that. it was just time, and I called Pavilion, and when I went there this time, like I had no plans of my own. I said, whatever you guys tell me to do, I'll do it. I'm totally all in. And
how long did you stay at Pavilion this time?
Like 7 months.
Last time.
Yeah, the last time, 7 months. I did the inpatient, went to their extended care, and then they had like a halfway house on the property at that time. So I stayed there and got back into school, was studying psychology at Tri-County Tech, and then I was going to transfer over to Clemson. So I stayed there for 7 months. I was commuting back and forth. I'd come back to Clemson for a week. I had a girlfriend in Clemson, so I'd see her, go to class, like it was a hybrid class, and then I'd go back up there and go to a lot of AA and NA meetings and work out a lot, just total, like, it was like, it's just like this boot camp for myself. Like it was my own like self-imposed boot camp, but I'll be like waking up like super early every morning, like had this solid routine, because while I was there, I made the decision. I'm like, you're never going to have this good of a chance to get back in shape again. Mm-hmm. I was like, so even if you don't stay sober, like you can at least get in shape while you're here. And that way it won't be for naught, you know? And that was the only relief I could find when I was going through the withdrawal, is to go run for like a mile. And then that helped me sleep at night. So then it just kind of started this thing. I started eating right and, you know, started this whole like wellness program, like my own personal program.
Do you remember if your mindset during those 7 months was, I'm never going to use again?
Yeah, I remember my parents came to visit me for the first time after a few weeks of being an inpatient. And I've had my last drink. That was like really in my head. Like I've had my last, like, you know, I've had my last go at this.
Yeah.
And I remember saying that to my dad. I was like, and with conviction, like I knew it. Like I was like, that's old life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm grateful for whatever that life taught me, but that's over. That chapter's closed. That door's closed.
And, at this point you're back in school. Mm-hmm. Are you back in music now too?
Playing a lot of acoustic. It's like the perfect thing to do when you're in rehab. But like I did like we had a creativity project. So I wrote a song. It was like kind of like a Valentine to like a goodbye Valentine to heroin. I wrote that and performed it. And, you know, so music has always been there. It mm-hmm. never went away. Like even when I pawned all my shit off, like I still had some sort of means to make music, whether it be on my computer or like an old guitar or something. Mm-hmm. So it was always there.
When you get out and you move back, I think probably to Clemson, mm-hmm. and you take a trip to Vietnam.
Yeah.
When was this trip? How did this trip come about? And what did it kind of teach you about yourself?
It was wild. I was intentionally, initially I wanted to study psychology. But my grades were so bad from before that they weren't going to let me in the psychology department, but the good old philosophy department, they let anybody in. So I had already taken some philosophy courses and I was like, sweet, I'll settle for that. Turned out to be the best thing ever. Like the philosophy department at Clemson is unbelievable. Like my teachers, it was the best experience, man. And I minored in psychology, so I still got some of the psychology that I wanted to learn about, but I didn't have to deal with like all the, cause it is a science, you know, it has all like the, mechanical parts to it. So I was studying philosophy, mostly I studied Western philosophy, and I was really itching to learn some more about the Eastern traditions. So I took a ancient Chinese philosophy class. And I'm looking at the map while I'm in class, just kind of daydreaming. I was like, man, I really want to travel to that part of the world. Don't know how I would do that. So I just kind of tabled it. And then after our first test, our teacher, he was a philosophy teacher and a Chinese language professor. So he like after our first test, I was the last one to turn it in. And he obviously knew I was really engaged in class and like always participating, like I was interested. And he looked at me after I turned the paper in, and he said, "You should come to China with me." And I was like, "Yes, I should." So I was like, because I mean, honestly, like 2 days before is when I was like really thinking about it. And
was this scary about your substance abuse or use at all?
No, not at that point. I was, so like they were, he takes a group of Chinese Mandarin students to Beijing every year. And this year he wanted to introduce like a cultural component to it. So they were going to study Chinese Buddhism as well. And so he invited me and this other girl who's a philosophy major to join them. You know, they gave us a scholarship. It was amazing. And like, I was like the uncle on the trip because I was older, you know, and they were younger and we were traveling in this foreign country and like had, I mean, the teacher was like, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing. But while I was over there, we did the course for like a month and traveled around China. It was incredible. But I was like, while I'm here, I want to get some more action. So I went to Vietnam. I broke off from the group and went solo to Vietnam and met up with this guy, this Vietnamese guy. And we jumped on a couple motorcycles and rode like 1600 miles over the course of a week.
What was your communication with them like?
he spoke what, good enough English. Yeah, it was good, man. It's just me and him. And
do you still keep in touch with
him? Oh yeah, I talk to him all the time. His name's Tong. He's one of the most beautiful human beings you'll ever meet. And we bonded instantly. Like it was a hardcore ride. Like we were going through like jungles and like total like remote wilderness of Vietnam, like going into these like small little villages where they didn't even have electricity. They like were brewing green tea on like the big like stove, like wood fire stoves. And they just welcomed us in, like didn't even know we were coming. And like we'd sit with them and eat with them and sleep there sometimes, sleep in hotels. So like me and him got really close on that.
Sure.
I mean, he was the man though. Like he was like straight up motorcycle ninja. Like he would take us all over the place, but he could fix everything. And I laid the bike down a couple times. It was just wild. I even wrote in my journal, like after the second night, I was like, if something happens to me on this trip, just know I died with a big fat smile on my face, you know, because it was intense.
So y'all were on the bike together?
No, we had two bikes.
Two bikes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you put down your bike a few times and then yeah. He would help you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But what was life back in Greenville? Did you have a job here? Did you have a plan when you got back? What were you currently doing?
Yeah, just school. And I had actually started working at Pavilion. So full circle, that the halfway house that I lived at, they converted that to a young men's extended care program. So like 18 to 26 year old kids, they needed somebody to come work with them and like kind of hang out with them on the weekends. So I would go to class all day or all week, go up there on Saturday and stay Saturday night. We'd go to meetings, go to the gym, hike, go out to eat, like do all like sorts of fun things, just kind of chaperoning and just sharing my experience. Cause mm-hmm. I had been there and, you know, I was a little bit older. And so it was just a good fit, but I left for 2 months for the trip to Asia. And I got back and they had given someone else my hours. They needed to fill those hours. So I was kind of looking for a job and I had spoke at Favor before and connected with Rich. You know, we just have very similar philosophies and outlooks mm-hmm. on things. And he said, if I ever need a job to reach out. And so I took him up on that and met with him and Hubert Yarborough and they hired me to work on their hospital team. So,
which is an intense position, if you can explain kind of what that is.
Yeah. So at first I was still in school. So I was living in Clemson. So what I was doing was more on call. I'd have a day, 24-hour block where I'd be on call. And what would happen is if somebody would come into the ER, it started mostly for overdoses. So if people would come in with an overdose, but it slowly transitioned to anyone that came in and they were looking for help with substance use disorder. Yeah. They would call and say, hey, it'd be any time of day and they or night, they call and say, hey, we got, you know, so-and-so 34-year-old guy, like just overdosed, wants some resources, wants to talk to somebody. So I drive over here to whatever hospital and, you know, just sit with them and just see what their game plan was and see how I might be able to help facilitate that, you know? And then that slowly, after I graduated in 2019, that became a full-time position where I would just go to Greenville Memorial and, you know, work from like 8 a.m. to 4 and just see people as they came in and just start to try to build relationships with them and just give them a resource.
What were some of the common resources you would try and provide?
Housing.
Or message.
Yeah. I mean, really, like, yeah, the connection element was the juice of it for me. I just, you know, people like you and me, and we have that network of support, you know, and that was, I would not have made it without that 100%, you know? And most of the people that I saw in the ER, especially the ones that came regularly, they didn't have that at all. For whatever reason, their family wasn't around, you know, total dysfunction or whatever. So to be able to like offer that support to them, like, was kind of my way of like balancing the karmic scale, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And, you know, to just try to just let them know that, hey, like, there's someone or a group of people, you know, favor that care about what you're going through. And just imparting that little bit of hope. And, you know, we give them, you know, resources for sober living and stuff like that. But I think the main thing I would hear so much is like, man, it's the first time anyone's actually given a shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is very powerful. I mean, it could be the most powerful thing when you're in that situation, because you think no one gives a shit.
Yeah.
And you think you're all alone. And just knowing somebody's there to have your back and talk to you and help you through the situation, I mean, saves lives. You work at Favor, and I know I want to get into your music. You have your EP came out in 2020.
Yep.
What's it called? What's it about? What type of music is it?
Yeah. So like all this time, I guess like 2018, I knew like music, I started just slowly building. Like I always had this dream. As soon as I learned what music producing or a music producer was, I was like, that is what I want to do. Like I went to Full Sail for that. It just became this thing that I was just completely enamored with, but I had, did not have the resources or the capacity to pursue it like I needed to. Finally, when my life started to stabilize with school, like, and I had money, I could finally start buying the gear I needed to do that. And by the time I had a little studio at my townhouse in Clemson while I was in school, started playing around with recording and producing. But by the time I moved to Greenville in 2019, like I moved into a house with a studio in mind. Like it was this old house downtown, but it has this old dining room that's perfect for like a big live room and a studio. So I put the time in to make that, and I knew I was going to put some music out. So I just worked, man. I would wake up at like 5 a.m. and before work, I would like put in like 2 hours in the chair, just practicing, learning tutorials and different things. But I came up with the name Catch the Rise. And it's just about like, there was so much inspiration and going on in my life for like more than ever before. I was writing and playing a lot, and I just was like, man, like I got to maximize this, because you don't know when these creative momentum is like, how long, because of my experience, those were kind of fleeting moments. So it was like about seizing that. And I was, you know, just recording a bunch of music throughout 2019 and into 2020. And I just was like, I've got to finish one song, because I was such a perfectionist when it comes to music. Like I'm hyper protective of it. And like, I'm very sensitive to like sharing it, you know, and I would always just keep working on songs because I'd be too scared to finish it, because then that means I'd actually have to put it out.
Yeah.
But I actually made the goal of putting out a single, which was 2020 is my first single. Put it out and was like, just did it.
Yeah.
And like I had read before, like that was like what you got to do, because then it just opens up the floodgates. And it did. throughout the course of the next few months, like last summer, I was just recording, like making songs, writing songs, and put together this EP and just kind of just let it go. And I called it Trust.
Trust?
Yeah.
But so it's electronic music, but it's also some live instruments, right? And so you do a lot of the both, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's electronic based. I use Logic, Apple's Logic production software. So like a lot of the drums and things like that are electronic. And then, but I play a lot of live bass, all the guitars live, and then there's some outboard synths too. But yeah, that was, I very influenced by Tycho, early on, Nine Inch Nails, Pretty Lights, Bonobo, things like that. I have a lot of hip hop influence too. Like I've always been fascinated with hip hop production. But yeah, so you definitely call it electronic. People call it ambient electronic or down tempo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was listening to some of it this morning and, I didn't know you just had, a remix to Catch the Rise come out in August. With all this going on and, you know, you feel like you're in a good position in life, do any of those feelings of substance use ever come back?
I guess they cross the mind. But for me, like I've learned that like alcohol to me and like any of those things that I was really bad on, like I listen to my body now. And like, to me, like I see all my friends getting hungover that when they get to get drunk, I'm like, that is all I need to know I'm not supposed to do that.
Yeah.
Like, a hangover is my body's way of telling me like, dude, what are you doing? And then like, even with like Xanax, like I'm actually prescribed Xanax when I fly. So like my doctor from Pavilion, I sat down with him. I said, dude, I'm miserable when I fly. Like I hate it. Like it's awful.
Yeah.
And he did this. And like while it works on the flight, I hate the way I feel after. Like I'm so groggy. Like I'm not clear. Like I hate that feeling. So I'm like, I can leave it alone, you know? And like, I have no doubt that if I were to start using it every day, I would totally go back. But now it's like, I see the picture more clearly. Like I know myself more. Not saying I'm cured by any stretch of the imagination. But it all like is clearer to me.
What is, what are you working on now?
Man, I'm putting my head down. Like I've put out a lot of music this year, like going at a really big pace. But I've been putting in a lot of work in the studio, like learning new gear, learning new techniques, putting together another collection of songs for another album. But I won't release it until it's done. Like I'm not setting a date and then like scrambling to get the stuff done and like cutting corners. Like the songs will be done like when they're done. And then I'll set a date. Like I'll shop it around to labels and stuff. I have a good connection with the label I've been on, High Vibe, out in California. And, you know, I'd love to work with them again, but you know, I'm putting all my focus on the songs and the music. And then I'll worry about promotion or distribution and all that.
Do you have any envisions of you doing live performances, being at, you know, shows, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Yeah. I definitely want to play some shows. I want to be able to perform. So like playing electronic music solo, doing that, it takes a lot of gear and practice, because to manipulate all the things you have and play live, like with looping and stuff like that.
Yep.
I would like to find a live drummer as well. But yeah, the live shows will be coming for sure.
Man, that would be the rush of adrenaline on a live show like that.
I miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we played some pretty big shows, some pretty big crowds with the Executives, and it was awesome. Such a rush. And I actually did some open mic stand up a couple years sober, because I feel like I felt this like calling to go be on stage and to get that rush. So I did get my fix with that. And that was being sober and like talking about like this stuff, like a comedy. It was intense, man. I'm really glad I did it though. But yeah, being like, that is something that I kind of crave. So I'm looking forward to that day whenever it comes.
Well, amazing. And as we're wrapping up here, is there, for somebody out there that might be struggling or might be, you know, going through something that could be similar to you, do you have something like a message or something for them to kind of take from this podcast?
Yeah, just that, you know, everybody's got problems. I mean, everybody's got something that they're struggling with. And just because you're like, just because mine was substances, just because somebody's might be substances, like that doesn't make it worse or any more dramatic, you know, than anyone else's issues. It's just unique to you. And there's nothing wrong with talking about it or, and, you know, kind of owning it and being like, hey, this is my obstacle. This is my challenge. What can I do to fix it? Cause everybody's got obstacles and challenges. You don't get out of this life without that, you know, as part of the deal.
Yeah.
So I think it's important. It was important for me to just own my own set of circumstances. I have so many good things in my life, but I also had this other, these other obstacles, and that applies now. It's just different.
Yeah.
So just being able to be like, hey, like I'm struggling with this, and just, and that knowing by doing that, the help will just come, will flow in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll find its way to you. You might have to be proactive and look forward a little bit, but it's out there.
Yeah, it'll naturally happen.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing, where can people find your music?
Yeah, I'm all over. I mean, Catch the Rise, so catchtherise.com. You know, Catch the Rise on Spotify, Catch the Rise on Instagram, Facebook. But yeah, it's all on there. And I mean, YouTube, but yeah, Catch the Rise.
Is there a story behind the name?
Well, yeah, so I was saying like the... I was in that mode of where all this creativity was flowing in. So trying to like seize that, yeah, like catch the rise, like make the most of that opportunity. That's where it came from.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, man, thank you so much for coming. It's been an honor to have you.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. This is really cool.
Yeah, and hopefully we can connect more. Absolutely. I'm sure we will.
For sure.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, click subscribe on your listening platform for upcoming conversations.